You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The return of Ryan Holiday to the podcast to talk about his latest book, Discipline is Destiny. So many fascinating stories that Ryan has uncovered new details in, whether it's Lou Gehrig, Dwight Eisenhower, Queen Elizabeth, and dozens more, to talk about this concept of how discipline and what kind of discipline, and it's not maybe what you think, what kind of discipline can change your life for the better. I have to say, this book and this interview had a big effect on me. So I hope it has that effect on you as well.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Ryan, how are things going with you? How's the bookstore?
Things are amazing. The bookstore is downstairs right now.
I am so proud of you for doing a book, for having your own bookstore. I've always wanted to have my own bookstore. And of course, I've never done it. I've done other things. I've had my own comedy club, but I'm much more interested in books and writing. I've always loved the idea of having some sort of bookstore. You did it. We're going to talk about Discipline is Destiny, your book. But I would have been dissuaded because bookstores are basically going down. Like Barnes & Noble is the walking dead.
Yes.
It's going to go out of business. Every time I walk into a Barnes & Noble, there's fewer books in the bookstore. You know, I know it's going out of business. Borders did the same thing. What made you go into to get a bookstore?
I would actually say your comedy club was part of that process for me. It's just the coolness of a physical space. The idea that when one is successful at what they do, it should allow them to pursue certain cool projects on the side and then be able to... Like, it's the bookstore still has to work as a business, but it doesn't have to work that well as a business. You know what I mean? So I'm insulated from I'm insulated a little bit from the wicked economics of the industry. But I think for me, like, at some point, what hit me was that, like, pretty much everything I do is digital and at scale, right? Like 60%+ of my book sales are digital. My podcast, right, all over the world, you know, millions and millions of downloads, YouTube, scale, digital, marketing, scale, digital. Everything I do is designed to be digital. And for a lot of people, most of whom I will never meet, I just got really excited about doing something real for a small group of people and the sort of craft and like place of it all. And it's been like one of the things I'm probably most proud of ever doing.
It is a great thing. Like, I felt the same way as you. All my businesses were always digital. And we all live in ones and zeros now.
Yeah.
And actually having a physical space I could walk to and call my own and other people go there to spend money for their pleasure, you know, because it was a comedy club. It made people laugh. And it was something a real thing I owned. And I have since sold it. And fortunately, I'm probably the one comedy owner in history to break even on my investment. Like you say, it just has to work. It doesn't necessarily work well. I think actually it's been doing very well since I left it.
I really needed physical space anyway. Like I wanted somewhere out of my house that I could write in, that I could have meetings in, that my employees could come and go from when they needed to. And my wife was basically also like, you got to get all these books out of our house. Like, it's just too much. And so, like, I was kind of...
So wait, are the books in the bookstore your book collection that you're selling?
No, upstairs. Like, instead of being a book hoarder at home, I can now keep all my books somewhere else, right? And so I was like, I needed the physical space. And I also needed, like, this is, I was doing the project before the pandemic and before everything went fully remote. But like, I needed like a space to film YouTube videos. I needed a space to film podcasts. I needed a space to like, to do what I do. And I didn't want that to be in a spare bedroom in my house or something. And so one of the best pieces of advice I got when I was doing when I was thinking about it, I asked this woman, Allison Hill. She owns Book Soup in Los Angeles, which is one of the great indie bookstores. And now she's the head of the ABA, which is like the American Booksellers Association. Anyways, she was saying that the three keys to opening a bookstore were, number one, you have to own the building. Number two, you have to have multiple uses for the space. And number three is you can't spend all your money on the reno. Like you have to sort of do it by pieces. So anyway, so like the idea for us of like having multiple uses for the space means that like the bookstore, it's not a charity, but like the office space and the productive function of the building already pays for everything. And then if people buy books, it's extra. And it turns out they do buy books and it's done amazing. And I'm doing the launch of the new book. Like I'm selling the books directly, which is new for me. All of that has made it work on like a handful of levels. So it's been a really awesome experience.
It's a real critical insight to have multiple uses of the space, particularly given the lessons the pandemic taught us, which is that the use of space is changing because of digital. Everybody that used to shop in stores now developed a habit of buying on Amazon. Like all the money's going to Seattle, which is a problem for major cities. And so having multiple uses is a lesson that every storefront owner needs to learn now, for better or for worse.
Yeah, I think so. And having some e-commerce element to what you do. So probably 30% of our sales are still online, which is pretty cool. And then I also feel like, though, because so much is online, it actually creates an opportunity for retail that is an experience, right? So like, as I thought about the bookstore, if I try to compete with Amazon or with Barnes & Noble, I'm obviously going to lose, right? Like if I try to carry every book that exists, I'm going to drown in inventory and I'm going to have to spend a ton in overhead. It's not going to work. So like we only carry like 700 books in the bookstore, which is...
Do you curate them?
Yeah. So I have read, my wife and I have read every single book in the bookstore and not just read it, but like love that book, right? So the average bookstore, like this is the other funny thing. I think you would love this. So like people are like, I don't want to support Amazon, this multi-billion dollar conglomerate. Like I want to support small businesses. But do you know who bookstores buy all their books from? Either directly from publishers, which are multi-billion dollar conglomerates, or they buy them from Ingram, which is like a $10 billion company in Tennessee that is a distributor for all the publishers, right? So the point is when you go to start a bookstore, you call up Ingram and they go, here are the 10,000 books that we recommend that you carry, right? And that's what a bookstore of our size should have. It should have 10,000 titles in it, which is insane. Like 10,000 books, like I can't even think of 1,000 great books, let alone 10,000 great books.
It's almost a sad thing because like 10,000 authors expect all to be read.
Yes.
And who reads all these books? Like you go to a bookstore, maybe you buy one book and maybe two. 10,000 people, you're leaving that bookstore, you're just leaving them unread. And everybody is doing that all day long. It's totally kind of sad to be a writer, unless you're like in the upper echelons of it.
And you think about it too, like how often do you walk into an independent bookstore and you're after a specific book? Like you walk into an independent bookstore for the discovery, right? So the idea that they would have 10,000 titles, which a human being couldn't possibly browse through, even in months of visiting a bookstore, is actually a really bad way of doing it. So the decision to have way fewer books, to put them face out, and to actually be able to recommend and rave about each one, it actually makes the shopping experience much better. And I think that's why the bookstores work. People come in and they're like, oh, I should read all these books, not like I should ignore all these books to maybe find the one that I'm interested in.
See, this is an interesting thing. And again, in the intro, I talked about Discipline is Destiny. We're going to get to it. It's a great book. I want to talk all about it. But I am really fascinated by the bookstore and what you're saying right now about capitalism. Because without the profit motive, And by the way, I'm a huge believer in capitalism, of course, but without the profit motive, you're creating a better experience. For instance, you say the books are face out. Well, in Barnes & Noble, the only way to be face out is if the publisher pays for that. Most people don't know that. So you're creating a better experience for your customer without the profit motive. And so I'm trying to just wrap my head around that because it seems to me unusual. Like a Soviet Union bookstore would not be as good as your bookstore, for instance.
But yet it's also actually is part of the profit motive. Like, did you ever go in an Amazon bookstore?
Yeah.
They did the same thing. They only had their best-selling titles and they were almost all face out. So I just took the idea from them, like in part. I was like, there's a reason that publishers pay to be face out. It's that it helps discovery. Like you look, if someone's looking at behind me and they see all the titles, it blends in and then like the mine sticks out because it's face out, right? So I was like, if that must also drive sales. So I'm just going to put the best stuff face out and people will be more likely to buy books. Here's the other thing. Most bookstores are also not driven by the profit motive, and it's why they don't do very well. Like when I walk into my average independent bookstore, they don't have my books, even though I know I sell a lot of books, because self-help is not a fancy literary category, right? Your books too, like they would sell your books, but they choose not to carry them because they'd rather carry this like, you know, intersectional, you know, protest poetry book that isn't going to sell any copies because it signals something to the kind of people that they're interested in impressing. And so I think far too often bookstores have been immune from the profit motive, even though publishing is actually a multi-billion dollar industry, like north of, you know, $50 billion a year. And I think Seth Godin's point once was that, you know, the vast majority of revenue in the publishing industry comes from the backlist, but all of the focus is on the front list. And yet when you walk into a bookstore, the vast majority of the attention is also focused on new titles or titles that have never sold well. And then you go, oh, I want to get this classic business book. You're like, I'd like Jim Collins' Good to Great. And they're like, maybe we have a copy way over here tucked in the corner, but that would actually be what would be selling copies for them if they decided to get behind it.
Right. Like if you think about it, the fact that you could say that book, and I know what you're referring to, and that's a book written in, if I believe I'm correct, 2001 or early 2002, and was an excellent business book. Some of the stories in it didn't age well, but the concept ages very well. And he was a kind enough author. I wrote him a letter in 2001 or 2002, right after he published the book, and he responded, and I was very grateful. It gave me a demonstration of how to be as an author, which I haven't always followed, but it was still a good demonstration.
No, it's a classic. You want to sell classics.
Yeah. What are some of the books behind you right now?
Behind me, let's see. This is the Winston Churchill set by William Manchester, which I love. This is a book I did with Chris Bosch called Letters to a Young Athlete. Seth Godin, here's The Dip.
Oh, yeah, classic.
Here is The Chancellor about Angela Merkel, which I enjoyed. Let's see, Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. I just read Isabel Wilkerson's Caste, which I really liked.
What's it about?
The racial caste system in America. Like that we think caste is something that only exists in India, but there is a very clear caste society and has been since the very beginning in America. You know, Native Americans, Black people, other races, white people.
Let me ask you a question, and this will begin the process of segueing to your book. Do you think caste and thinking it, caste is a way of measuring status? So in India, where like you said, the word caste, we sort of think of that. There's a strict hierarchy. This is the highest caste. Untouchables is so low, it's not even considered a caste. And you can't marry out of your caste, or if you're lucky, you can marry up. But it seems to me it's probably a natural human instinct. Like even writers. Oh, did you make it to the New York Times bestseller list? Then you're in the highest caste of writers. Are you published in bookstores, or did you sell? There's different castes of writers. Like everything you could possibly be interested in that's worth it is measured by all these almost demeaning metrics that have nothing to do with the process.
Yeah.
And we slot ourselves into the appropriate cast. A, how has that affected you as a writer, as someone who wants to improve as a writer and as a great accomplished author that you are now? B, is it a negative in general, or is there positives to it?
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Like human beings, like almost all animals, inherently think about status and hierarchy and where we rank in the status and hierarchy. And there's anxiety, worry, fear, ambition is all tied up in, you know, are we at the top? Where's our place? You know, can we beat this person? Have they done more than us? Obviously, that I think is probably profoundly evolutionary and biological. And a lot of it can be very frustrating. Yeah, as you said, like I'd sold well over 1 million books before I hit the New York Times bestseller list for the first time. So the lists are not even remotely representative of who is selling best. It's an artificial category, you know, that's filtered for a bunch of made up criteria that certain gatekeepers have decided that they get to decide, right? So if you're saying like, is hierarchy, is this kind of caste system good or bad? I would say, provided that it is fluid and real and based on actual merit, you know, I have no problem with, you know, sorting, you know, players in the NBA by points scored or, you know, sure, number of rings won. And provided that any one person can has the agency to change their place in that system. The problem with most caste systems, first off, at least in India, there's an acknowledgement that the caste system exists. America has always told itself it's a meritocracy when in fact it had a very clear caste system. So I dislike the dishonesty of it. But I would say the problem with a caste system is that people begin to associate their worth or someone else's lack of worth with things that have nothing to do with that person or what that person's done, right? So their argument right. for a lot of the political unrest we have now or anxiety or worry or polarization, it has a lot to do with people feeling like their perceived place in the caste, in the caste system that they've always had, that like, you know, that basically she argues in the book that for all of America's history, the lowest rung of a white person could confidently feel themselves better than the most successful Black person, right? That was how that worked, that you always were better than the people beneath you, no matter how talented or successful or brilliant they were. You could always remind them of their place and of their inferiority to you, right? This is why lots of Southerners who did not own slaves fought in the Civil War. They wanted to protect their place in a system, not exactly the institution of slavery. If you see the Confederacy as a mechanism to enforce a caste system, it makes more sense than as a system to protect slavery as an institution, although those two things are related. So I think the big problem with a caste system is that people begin to think that they are better, that these made-up labels or that history or the things that went into this moment say anything about them, which of course they don't.
And so on the one hand, I think what appeals to me in a lot of your books, including this Discipline is Destiny, is that you look at features beyond the caste of what, obviously you write stories about famous people because we relate to those, we partially know the stories, you add features that we learn lessons from. And it's very much Robert Greene style. Yes. One of your mentors, you know, who wrote 48 Laws of Power and many other great books. But like take Lou Gehrig is one of your stories. And you quoted statistics, 400, whatever it was, 95 home runs, 350 RBI. But then you tell this deeper story of why it was, what was it about his childhood, his nature, his temperament that made him show up for over 2,100 straight games in a row, even as he was succumbing to, you know, what became known as Lou Gehrig's disease and ALS. So you kind of start almost with these caste-like metrics, but then tell the real story. I think this is the story of Stoicism, is going beyond kind of the instinct for hierarchy to find out what really makes the person, you know, a good person.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm definitely fascinated by people who were great. And I don't mean great in the sense that they accomplished a lot. Like, I think that's what's so interesting about Lou Gehrig is that his greatness, like one of his teammates says, he was the greatest man, the finest man who ever walked the earth. And then he's like, you know, he woke up early. He went to bed early. He worked hard. You know, he never smoked or drank. And he's like, these are pretty ordinary things that you're using to describe someone as transcendent. You know, what is that about? Like, I'm interested in people who were great, not necessarily because they accomplished a lot, although they often do, but they had something in them that just kind of separated them from someone else. And I'm trying to either highlight the virtue of that or provide, as Robert Greene sort of taught me to do, the cautionary element of like either a personality flaw or a virtue taken too far. So I'm interested in not just like, hey, here's a good thing to do. I'm interested in illustrating it through a complex, complicated person in such a way that, you know, part of that maybe rubs off on their reader.
Well, it's interesting, sort of the separation between the normal feature and the almost transcendent, like historical features. Like you mentioned in two different sentences, very close to each other, Dwight Eisenhower, at the peak of him being the supreme military commander of post-war Europe, he was responsible in some way or other for the lives of 700 million people.
Yeah.
But the story is really about him quitting smoking. And which again is an ordinary feature, but unbelievably hard. Like nicotine is incredibly addictive and people smoke despite the fact it takes on average 11 years off of your life. And you can't always do what he did. Was you said he just stopped one day and that was it. That's hard for many addicted people, but that's the story. That's what makes him transcendent to you. Not that he controlled 700 million people.
Well, I think both are obviously transcendent. I highlight like his immense amount of power to make the point that no one could tell him what to do, right? Like he was literally the most powerful man on the earth, right? He has nuclear weapons before the Soviets have nuclear weapons. He literally could have destroyed the whole world if he wanted to, right? And what does he do with this power? He says freedom is the opportunity for self-discipline. And so his point was that from all this power, all this fame, all this access, everything that he's done, you know, what that really meant was that he had to be in charge of himself. There's a great line from Seneca. Seneca says, like, he is worthy of power who is under their own power, right? And so even when I'm talking about Eisenhower's decision to stop smoking, I'm trying to make the point that, again, he can do whatever he wants. And yet it's this immense struggle, this discipline to be like, I'm going to get, he says, I gave myself an order to stop smoking, right? Like the hardest thing to do is actually that, right? Like lots of people become, you know, lead big armies, but then they have trouble quitting small habits. And so to me, it was a study in contrast that we often think that the real benefit of becoming powerful, becoming CEO, becoming rich, is that we become exempt from the rules, that we get to do anything and everything we want. But in reality, success and power and fame, all this really demands of you is that you be a better boss to yourself than anyone could be the boss of you.
I think this is an important lesson, and it's not an easy one. Like, no. I've read biographies of Eisenhower, for instance, and it goes through the chronology of his life. Childhood, you know, military commander, president, on and on. But I don't think I've ever read that he was either a smoker or had stopped smoking in any of his biographies. So what's great about this book is you're showing, the book is obviously Discipline is Destiny, and you're showing how it's not because he was supreme military commander that he then became president. Like we often think external news headline success breeds more success. But what you're saying here is that these small disciplines are so important to create that success and are so often ignored. Like in every story, like your style is you have this point, discipline creates your destiny. And then you have these various stories, Lou Gehrig, Eisenhower, Joyce Carol Oates, who I've read about. I've read many of her books. I've read all about her. You describe stories and quotes I had never seen or heard before. Like you're always bringing something new to the table. And really the focus was on her discipline. I didn't even know how prolific she was until you wrote it in this book. But it's a hard lesson. Like you say towards the end of the book, you have some stories about you should do your best. Yeah. When someone tells me to do my best, I'm trying. I don't, what do you mean? Like, how do I do it? Why am I not doing my best? What does it look like I'm not doing my best? What's going on? How do you do your best? So Jay, I was about to read this ad for Mint Mobile, but then you tell me that you're switching to Mint Mobile. What are you switching from?
I want to switch from AT&T to Mint Mobile. I'm paying like almost $200 a month.
Well, what's Mint Mobile going to charge you?
Maybe $50 a month. That's like a huge difference.
And I know that they start at 15.
Oh, wow.
Mint Mobile, they sell online only, so they don't have all the overhead of supporting all these useless stores. That's kind of their secret sauce, I think. So by cutting out the retail store, there's no crazy overhead costs that you have to pay, essentially pay for in these mystery fees. They have unlimited talk, the nation's largest 5G network. So you can take your phone that you got from AT&T. You could use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. Mint Mobile gives you the best rate whether you're buying for one or a family. Family start at two lines. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get this plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/James. You got to do the slash James because then they will treat you like royalty. That's mintmobile.com/James. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at MINT, mintmobile.com/James. And Jay, you know, I think I'm going to switch along with you.
Yeah, let's go. I just want to talk to Ryan Reynolds. That's it.
Yeah, that's right. He's the guy. We'll get him on the podcast if we keep doing these ads.
Yeah, let's do it.
I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was four plane rides, like to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
probably the best biographer to ever write was this guy Plutarch, who I'm sure you've read. Actually, his grandson is Marcus Aurelius, his philosophy teacher, as it happens. But Plutarch writes this book, Lives of the Eminent Greeks and Romans. And he writes a number of essays and profiles of these sort of major figures from, you know, 500 years or so behind him and up to the present. And he has this great observation. He says, you can often find out more about a person in an offhanded comment, in, you know, a singular exchange or incident, than you can in a vivid retelling of their greatest deeds or campaigns. And his point was that we often get to the essence of one of these people, not in the, as you said, the point-by-point chronology of what they did, not in portraying exactly what happened here or there, but in the revealing moments where they illustrated what was really driving them. And to me, again, Eisenhower, this idea of like, I gave myself an order to stop smoking, to me is like that you get the essence of who this man was from that exchange. So I'm interested in finding that. And to go to your point about doing your best, well, I found this story about Jimmy Carter that really struck me, that Jimmy Carter actually writes, I know you're living in Georgia now, writes in his campaign biography when he's running for governor of Georgia. This is where he first tells his story.
By the way, which was titled, Why Not the Best?
Yes, yes, exactly.
I read it when he was running.
So people don't think of Jimmy Carter, like they think of Jimmy Carter as this kindly old man. They don't think about him as an ambitious young naval officer, which he was. He goes to the U.S. Naval Academy. And I told this story when I spoke there not long ago. He's at the U.S. Naval Academy. He graduates. And his dream is to work on a nuclear submarine. And to make it into a nuclear submarine, you have to be personally interviewed at that time by this guy, Admiral Hyman Rickover, who's probably one of the greatest but less known Americans of the 20th century. And Rickover, they do this long interview. It's kind of like a podcast. It's like a 2-hour interview or 3-hour interview. They talk about all these complex topics. They talk about physics. They talk about strategy. You know, they talk about everything. And then Rickover asks Carter, he says, you know, how did you stand in your class at the Naval Academy? And he says, you know, I was 50th out of a class of 800. He's very proud of himself. And Rickover, who has seen probably number 1 through 49 in the Naval Academy already, goes, but did you always do your best? And Carter kind of, like you said, we like to think we're always doing our best, but we're not actually really tested on it, right? It's like a lie we can tell ourselves. And so Carter goes to be like, yes, of course, I've always done my best. But then he kind of thinks about it, and he thinks about all the moments that he kind of stopped short, or he coasted, or he tried to not be the center of attention, or he could have done more. And he goes, you know what, sir, I don't think I have always done my best. And Rickover looks at him and he says, why not? And then he gets up and he leaves the room. And this question of like, have I always done my best? It haunts Carter for the rest of his life. And if you see him then through the lens of this guy always trying to do his best, you start to understand his greatness, also some of his flaws. You understand the mistakes that he made. And so to me, it's not, I'm not saying like do your best and it's this kind of cliche. Obviously, people know they should do their best. But I was trying to tell this story to leave the reader, hopefully, because I was left with it, the kind of hauntingness of that question of like, why didn't you always do your best? Like what stopped you from it? And hopefully that can linger as we, you know, I think about this as I'm working on a book right now. There's things I could do that would make it easier, right? Like there's things I could do that would cut corners and I know it would still do pretty well. But to stick with the process, you know, to stick to my standards, it requires, I think, a little bit being haunted by that question.
Everything ultimately is about process. So you're not a writer because you're on the New York Times bestseller list. That has nothing to do with writing. You're mm-hmm. a writer because, as you point out in the stories about Toni Morrison and Joyce Carol Oates, for instance, you found time to write when nobody else was, and you worked really hard at it and studied it and developed these stoic-like habits around the discipline of it and slowly built a career. And you've done this, and every other writer in history pretty much has done this. It's when you get too focused on the external dressings of like, oh, are you on this list or that list? I think that the quality goes down in every case. Like Lou Gehrig, you compared Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth's one of the best players in history, but ultimately had some severe problems in life because of a certain lack of discipline in many smaller parts of his life. And Lou Gehrig was able to survive kind of almost the most horrific scenarios. And you became very attracted to the story of Lou Gehrig. I could tell your love for that story throughout the book. And, you know, it really shines a light that what's great is not the way he hits a baseball, but who he is before that, that allowed him to hit the baseball the way he did and have the perseverance to show up for games with, why show up for games with broken fingers? Was that doing his best for himself? Clearly it was for him. But again, the question is not, where did you do your best? It's why not do your best? Like I know for myself, I never say, oh, I did my best here, here, and here. It's more like what you just said is, where can I be better? The negative actually gives us information. The positive never gives us information. Oh, I was great here, so I should do this again.
No, you're totally right. The question is why. It's really about why you didn't do your best. And why, like, I think for Gehrig, right, he seems to be motivated by this not wanting to cheat the game, right? Like, not wanting, like, and it seems weird to argue that Babe Ruth did this because he was so great, but Babe Ruth did cheat the game. Like, Babe Ruth was fat, Babe Ruth was lazy, Babe Ruth was drunk all the time, Babe Ruth was reckless, Babe Ruth did not respect the game. Babe Ruth was inordinately naturally talented and loved the applause and the rewards of the game, but like there was no part of him that, from what I could gather, like deeply loved the act of doing it and had a kind of a reverence and respect for the process of it. So even when you look at the greatness of Babe Ruth, you have to be haunted a little bit by like the insane fact that he could have been even better. Like, he could have done more. And what's insane about Lou Gehrig is, like, his career is cut short, but there's no part of looking at the years he was physically able to play and able to go, he could have done more.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so Babe Ruth, what we have there is we missed out on some joy because your point is he did not respect the game enough to hone in his bad habits, as small or as big as they were, and really be disciplined. He had so much potential, as many people say about young people. He had so much potential and did not live up to it. And what joy did he deprive hundreds of millions of fans of because of that? And your point then is, whether it's writing, whether you have a job at a company, maybe perhaps the way to think about doing your best is, do you have reverence for what you're doing, for the institution of what you're doing, to the ethic of what you're doing? You have reverence for it, so it inspires you. Like Dwight Eisenhower realized he didn't quit smoking because he thought it was bad for him.
Yeah.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but he could have quit it earlier. But it was that moment when he was becoming emperor of the planet, basically, that he said, I need to stop smoking.
Yeah, he's like, I can't afford to die of a heart attack. That's what he was saying.
Yeah, and he wouldn't be able to perform if he was in the hospital sick from a heart attack or lung cancer or whatever. And you clearly have a reverence for writing. You've told bits and pieces of your stories in your books, but you basically moved out of the big city where you could have been super successful. You moved to a small town. What are you, like 50 miles outside of Austin, something like that?
Yeah, probably more like 30, but I'm right outside Austin, yeah.
Yeah, and so you kind of almost, out of reverence for the fact that you wanted to be a writer and not like a millionaire or whatever, you did all of these things to become the best writer you could be, extremely successful. How many books now have you written? I met you the day you published your first book.
Yes. I think it's 14. I don't know the exact number. It's between, it's more than 10, less than 15.
And that required you to take it, have these disciplines. Like, you basically, you know, you practice what you preach. And so maybe that's a way. I think this is such an important question. How do you do, when they say, why not the best, or am I doing my best? Of course I should do my best. I wouldn't want to not do my best, but it's very, very difficult. and you've given me this lens just now of how to look at it. Like, why am I not doing, why am I not showing reverence? How am I, in what ways am I not showing reverence for something I want to be good at? Am I, do I have too much negative self-talk? Do I not have enough confidence? Am I not studying the proper way? Am I not devoting the right amount of time to the right activities? Am I just fooling around in batting practice instead of really videotaping my swing and analyzing it with a coach afterwards? Like, there's many ways to establish reverence, and it's so easy to not do it.
Well, and the weird thing is, like, reverence, I think people, it almost makes us uncomfortable, right? Like, to call it a gift or to feel reverence for it or to respect it. Or, like, did you read, I don't watch Succession, but did you see that? There was that big controversy about one of the actors in Succession. He was, like, profiled by the New York Times. And they basically, it was this sort of, like, subtle mocking piece, sort of the joke being on the actor for, like, giving a shit, for, like, taking the craft seriously and himself seriously as a result. I think it's easier to kind of be ironic or irreverent or cynical about things. And there, I think to do your best, it requires a certain amount of self-discipline. I think justice is tied up in here too. It's unjust to cheat the world of potential gains or innovations because, you know, you are lazy or because you're afraid of what other people might think. And to me, honestly,
or you had it for the fair.
Yeah, right. Yes. But the other part of it is, like, there's a certain amount of courage in it, right? Like, Jerry Weintraub tells this story about how he and James Caan are both studying at the Actors Studio. And I tell the story in the first book, Courage is Calling, but they're both studying it at the Actors Studio, and they have to do this class, and the class requires that they wear tights. And so they go to some, you know, dance store on Broadway, and they put on the tights, and James Caan looks at them, puts them on, feels ridiculous, buys them, and Jerry Weintraub can't do it. He's like, I cannot be seen in these tights. And he's like, that's why James Caan goes on to be one of the greatest actors of all time. And he's like, I never acted in anything. There, it requires a certain amount of courage to be like, I don't give a shit what other people think. I think this is important. I care about it. I'm going to do my best. And, like, I don't care if you laugh at me. I don't care if you think that I'm egotistical. I don't care if you think that I'm silly. I don't care if you think that I'm lame. I actually care about this, and that's why I'm doing my best.
So this is a great story about discipline, because so there's a couple of things to unpack there. One is James Caan clearly realized to himself the benefit. He loved acting. He loved the process of acting. It wasn't a joke to him. It yeah. wasn't like, oh, anybody can go on stage and repeat memorized lines. He wanted to take it seriously. So he had reverence. And it wasn't, you mentioned the words gift earlier. It's not a gift in the sense that even if you have potential, even if you have a gift, you need that discipline
sure.
to unlock it. And again, I'm going to use the word, I'm overusing the word reverence because I like it better than doing your best, because it makes a link between what you're doing and the disciplines of it. It's you have faith and belief in something that if I do the things that make me better at this, I will be a better person as a result. But it's also deciding what you have reverence for. Like Jerry sure. Weintraub had reverence for other things in the entertainment industry, sure. not acting. He didn't have enough belief in the benefits of acting for his life to have the discipline, to develop the disciplines to be successful at it. And you see that a lot. What if somebody doesn't have reverence for anything? Can they still be disciplined? Every story you mention, somebody loves something. Toni Morrison didn't wake up at 5 a.m. every day to write her amazing novels because she wanted to win a Nobel Prize and be famous. She yeah. did it because she loved writing.
Sure.
And what if she didn't? What if she didn't love anything?
I think it's really hard, right? There's a quote from Seneca. He says, if you don't know what port you're sailing towards, no wind is favorable. I think it's really hard to be committed to something, to do your best, to know what to do or not do, what to say yes to or say no to, if you don't know where you're trying to go. And then also, like, if you decide that life has no meaning, then everything becomes meaningless. If you decide that certain things, that life does have meaning, then it means that certain things also become meaningful. So I think, you know, cynicism is a choice. General Mattis had this great line once I heard. He said, cynicism is cowardice, right? Like, because if you think about being cynical, deciding that nothing matters, deciding that you don't respect anything, that you don't believe in anything, it's kind of the ultimate cop-out, because then it means you don't have to try, you don't have to be hard on yourself, you don't have to worry about anything. Like, when you sort of go, lol, nothing matters, it's true. Nothing matters to you.
Well, and you know, that's... So the word, obviously, the word cynicism is related to the Greek school of philosophy, the Cynics, which was side by side with the Stoics, and they took it a little more extreme. You once told me several years ago, Cynics are like Stoics without clothes.
Yes, yes.
Because often they didn't care about anything. They would just walk around naked, or...
Diogenes would famously just walk around masturbating.
And yet it's still like an acclaimed school of philosophy, but they weren't the advisors to emperors. Even though the emperors would sometimes beg them, like Alexander the Great is famously known to do that. And yet the Stoics still realize that participating in society is important at any level. And on that any level thing is important, because you have the Lou Gehrig story side by side with Dwight Eisenhower. So here's a guy who's reconstructing the entire planet after a world war. And here's another guy who swings a piece of wood at an 80-mile-per-hour ball. And we love both of them, right? Yes. Baseball is, quote-unquote, just a game. But it's America's pastime, whatever. We give it adulation for a variety of reasons. But it doesn't matter what it is you have reverence for. Your goal to be good at something complex and difficult essentially means mastering yourself.
Yes. It matters what you do with the unique circumstances or gifts or opportunities in front of you. So we each have our own calling. Some of them are enormous. Some of them are humble. But I think if you do them right and you do them well, there's an immense amount of meaning and greatness in them. There's a story I love in the book about this Greek general who sort of everyone sees as this threat. So they give him this job, basically being in charge of the city's sewers. And they think he's going to be like humiliated, that he has to like basically, you know, clean up people's shit and piss. And he says, no, it's a man who brings distinction to the position, not the position to the man. And he does like an amazing job, and he cleans up the city and everything's operating well. And it actually becomes, as a result of the work that he does, it actually becomes a respectable sort of sought after position. And so I think it's about what we do individually with what we have and with what we can do. And if everyone does that, the world becomes a better place. I think my problem with the cynics is like, it's great for somebody to be like, I get rid of all my possessions, I'm going to live on the fringes of society, question everything, laugh at everything, criticize everything. Like, that's great, but somebody has to do the stuff, right? Somebody has to keep people safe. Somebody has to invent new things. Somebody has to treat the sick, right? Somebody has to create art. Somebody has to teach children, right? Somebody has to do all that stuff. And so if everyone opts out or drops out, you know, the world doesn't work. And so I think it's like the Stoics would kind of believe that we each have our own, it's like, ironically, we each have our own discipline that we then have to be disciplined about.
And there's a really interesting story in the book which highlights that, I think, in an interesting way. Do you want to tell the story about Arthur Ashe's dad? So Arthur Ashe was one of the most amazing tennis players in history from the 60s and 70s, and black tennis player, probably the first black winner of Wimbledon, one of those, stories. And tell that great story about an experience his father had.
So his dad was this really interesting figure. He's sort of this self-made man in Virginia, sort of hustles together all these odd jobs to support his kids, has like some rental properties, and he has a job over here and a job over here and a job over here. He's like sort of a park supervisor. He basically does a little bit of everything to make a better life for his kids. And one of the jobs he has in what was then the segregated South is he's a driver for this Jewish businessman who owns a department store in the South. And you might think that this Jewish businessman is very successful and rich and important, which he was, compared to his Black driver, talking about a caste system again, but compared to whites in that town, he is an other. He is less than. And so there's this story where his father is the businessman that he works for is going out. He's trying to buy this piece of property. And it happens to be that the man he's buying it from is both racist and anti-Semitic. And so Arthur Ashe's father drives his boss out there, and he's able to watch this negotiation where the department store owners are trying to negotiate for the property. And the owner is just like unpleasant. He's being rude. He's talking down to him. He's being anti-Semitic. And ultimately, the department store owner puts up with all of it, completes the negotiation, buys the property. And then as they're driving away, Arthur Ashe's father says, you know, how could you do that? Like, and think about what it must have, how bad it must have been for a Black man in the South to say, how could you have put up with that kind of indignity? If you consider the kind of indignity that he had to put up with on a daily basis. And the business owner looks at him and he goes, look, I wanted to buy that piece of property. I now own that piece of property and he doesn't. Nothing else matters. His point was, you know, to get upset by it, to get offended by it, to retaliate would deprive him of the very thing he wanted, which was what he thought getting the better end of that business transaction. And so he was willing to be in command of himself, to ignore slights and provocations to get what he wanted, which he does. And you could argue that this is exactly what Arthur Ashe does as a tennis player in a segregated country, where his white opponents can throw temper tantrums, can break rackets, can live extravagant, flashy lifestyles, and he can't. And Arthur Ashe figures out a way to survive in that system, to subtly undermine that system, and ultimately triumph over and beat that system, and then bring about sort of much needed change within it. And he would always say that that story from his father shaped that approach for him, that like, I have something I want. And so by losing my temper, getting offended, losing control of myself, I'm not winning by doing that. I'm actually costing myself, and I'm giving that person who doesn't like me, who's judging me, who wants to see me fail, I'm actually giving them what they want.
It's so interesting because what I see in that story also is that outcomes are a side effect of discipline, which is your point when in the title, Discipline is Destiny. Because, for instance, the institution this Jewish businessman had reverence for, and I'll use that word again, is owning real estate and building his real estate empire. And so he knew the discipline it would take to get what he wants, to get the outcomes he wants. But he could have just as easily been, I'm going to always support Judaism and not tolerate any anti-Semitism. And he could have stood up for himself the way Martin Luther King did in the story you describe about Martin Luther King letting the Nazi hit him.
Sure.
And that's another story in the book. So, but the discipline would probably have been the same. You have respect for something that's greater than you. And what am I not doing that's respectful enough so that I could learn to be better at what I'm doing? So he could have had a different outcome, but still behaved in a way that would have shown discipline and that he had a strong core.
Well, I'm writing about this now. It's like when you know what your North Star is, when you know what the most essential, important thing is, then it allows you to say, yeah, how should I respond to this? What matters here and what doesn't matter? And yeah, you're right. If you're a social activist, then standing up for your race or religion is what duty is demanding of you in that situation. If your job is advancing your family and your people's interest by succeeding in business, by showing, you know, your skill or aptitude, then, you know, your North Star tells you, hey, don't let this person rile you up or get you. You think of Jackie Robinson, right? Like Jackie Robinson was not this like passive guy. I mean, he was a civil rights activist from his early days. When he played basketball in college, he would fight people who would say racist things to him. He gets kicked out of the army for refusing to go to the back of the bus, right? On base, which was at that time a violation of federal law. And so when he makes it into Major League Baseball, or in fact is chosen to break the color barrier in professional baseball, he's told and understands that they need someone who is strong enough, brave enough, controlled enough, disciplined enough to not fight back. And the amount of of abuse and provocation and physical antagonism that Jackie Robinson faces in those years in the league are immense. But he understands that the purpose of what they were doing was to get him to prove that he was not in control of himself, that he didn't deserve to be there, and that no one like him deserved to be there. And so he understood his North Star was to be, one, a great fucking baseball player, and two, to not give in or be distracted by the bad faith efforts of these people who wanted to see him fail. So I think it comes down to like, what are you trying to do? What is the most important thing? What is the thing that you have reverence for? And only once you have that can you decide how to respond or react in these individual scenarios.
In that case with Jackie Robinson, and this happens with a lot of stories, is it that he has two North Stars? So like you said, Branch Rickey, who was the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers at the time, he didn't want just a great baseball player. That was one criteria. But he knew Jackie Robinson was a great player, just like many other players. He wasn't necessarily the best player in the Negro Leagues at that time. But Branch Rickey specifically asked them, can you turn the other cheek? Can you not fight back? That was the criteria that was important to him. And so you think Jackie Robinson, of course he had the North Star of being a great baseball player, but do you think he had a bigger one also to move the needle on segregation and racism?
I think that's totally right. He doesn't have the luxury of just being a great baseball player, which is basically everyone else in the league only has to think about that. And it's important. I heard this quote about Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers once. His wife was saying, when you make him out to be a saint, you overlook how hard he worked, right? That like if you look at Jackie Robinson and you go, oh, he was just bigger than all of it. If you look at Jackie Robinson and you just go, yeah, he just never let him if you try to ascribe it to like his personality or that it's some sort of just thing he had, you're actually cheating him of the true sort of, I'm going to use this word, majesty of his accomplishment, which was, he was a human like everyone else. He had a temper like everyone else. He felt the pitches and the slides with the spikes out and the racial slurs. He felt every single one of those. He was just in such command of himself, and he had such clarity about what he was trying to do that he never retaliated, fought back, or lowered himself to doing what I think any normal human being would be entitled to do in that situation.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests and having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
So, it's interesting, like how many of these stories, how many of these people that show extraordinary discipline have a larger North Star than it seems? Like, and I'm sticking to baseball, not because I love baseball, but because maybe the opposite. It's just a game,
yeah.
Right? So it's hard. It's like saying, oh, this guy's the greatest bridge player or whatever.
Yeah.
Let's study his life. But does everybody need a further North Star that's even greater than what their worldly success speaks to? Like, yeah, Lou Gehrig, did he have a greater North Star?
I mean, I think first off, like, you have to take the thing that maybe isn't important to everyone else. It has to become really important to you. Like, writing, sometimes I step back and I look at writing and I think just how silly it is. Like, here I am just, like, arranging words on the page that I think sound cool. And, you know, I sometimes just try to remind myself that what I do is silly. But also, it's not silly. It's really important to me. Like, it means something to me for, I don't know why. I don't know why it became my thing or how it became my thing, but it is my thing. And like, I feel like earnestly, like, just loving the craft of what you do, that is an important North Star. But I think, you know, for someone like Lou Gehrig, baseball was like a way out. It was a way, I mean, he's playing baseball in the middle of the Depression, in the middle of a world war. It was at that time America's game. Like, I think he very much saw himself as a role model, as an exemplar, as a story of the American dream. I mean, he's a child of two impoverished immigrants who, you know, makes it good in the world. And I think that he saw himself as a representative of his race at that time, you know, because of World War I and World War II, there's a lot of German discrimination inside America. And he saw himself as, you know, being, it feels weird to see him as similar to Jackie Robinson, but saw himself as representing his race and his people and wanting to push back against, you know, suspicions or racism at that time. So I think he had a larger why of that. But I also think that for whatever reason, the game came to mean something to him that he didn't take lightly. And I think somebody who's a professional pool player, that seems like even less serious than baseball, but there must be some part of it for them that they connected to that means something. And I don't think we should brush that off. I think we should respect it.
And in referencing, you know, Robert Greene's book, Mastery, I think there's a magic to mastery, and mm-hmm. not necessarily the outcome of mastery, which is being the best at something, but the process of it. And I think whether it's the pool player or the baseball player or the general or the president or the queen or the writer, I think there's a respect for mastery also. It's like you touch the sublime when you're carving yourself to be a master of something. And I think a little bit for all of these people, all of these stories, amazing stories that you tell, you tell the ups and the downs. Like Ralph Ellison, amazing writer, Invisible Man is one of the most beautiful books ever written, but he couldn't really write again because he was obsessed with perfectionism. And so he disrespected not only writing, but the process of mastery. We don't have the next book from him, really, the next great book from him.
No, that's right. I mean, I feel like, you know, Robert Greene calls it our life's task, which I think is a really great phrase. Like, what is the thing that you were put here to do that only you can do? And I think when you look at Ralph Ellison's story, and I'm fascinated by Ralph Ellison because Invisible Man's one of my favorite books, you know, he really gets caught up in the literary scene, right? Like, he enjoys being the author of The Invisible Man more than he likes being the humble writer sitting alone in the room making stuff. And I think that ultimately leads him astray a little bit. I mean, I see this in you. Like, you writing and speaking like your individual truth is I see so clearly that it's your life's task, even though you're good at chess, even though you're good at investing, even though you're good at public speaking, like, you can't not do that thing. And I notice how always it's going into some new outlet for you, whether it's stand-up comedy or answering questions on Quora or podcast. Like, you, there's some part, like I wouldn't say you're just a writer because you seem to function in lots of different mediums, but there is some part of you that feels compelled to, like, articulate or explain some point of view about the world, and you, like, can't not do that.
And, you know, it's funny because whenever you're trying to achieve some life's task, as Robert Greene would call it, people are not going to like you for it.
For sure.
Because maybe they're not doing it, or maybe they don't like what you're saying or doing. And that's part of the discipline, is the psychology of managing that.
Yes.
And managing yourself through the difficult times of that. Well, let me ask you, what, clearly you also have some higher goal you're going towards. What is that?
Yeah, to me, it's definitely writing. Like, writing is the thing that I find gives me meaning and relief and excitement. And
But you don't write superhero comics.
No.
You write books about stoicism.
I feel like my ability or my calling is to make ancient wisdom accessible and practical in everyday life. And I take an immense amount of satisfaction, both like hearing from people who that's benefited, but I also, like, the sheer puzzle of doing it is fulfilling and meaningful, and what I practice. Do you know what I'm saying? Like this book is coming out, but like I spent the first 3 hours this morning like moving pieces around on the book that I'm doing after this. And that's really like what I love. I love the process of doing it. And then publishing is this interruption to that thing. What I really love is taking ideas, like even the stories that we're telling, like the fact that I found those stories and brought them to people. And like you said, like you hadn't heard some of them. Like, that's what I love doing, because I love the process of hearing things that I also didn't know about.
I mean, there's a lot to study there. Like, and for anybody who wants to be a writer or a communicator, I would almost like re-listen to what you just said, because like in the aftermath of this book, you write about a little bit about the process and some of the troubles you had during the process of writing this book. And it was interesting to me, and this is about, again, what happens on the path to mastering something, is that the situation itself that you're in needs to speak to you in a weird way. You can't fight the situation. So what I mean by that in your story is, when you were organizing your car, you were stuck in the writing of this book. You were organizing your index cards. You've written before about your writing process. You were organizing your index cards, and somehow or other, you mentioned some stories, Lou Gehrig, Churchill, Eisenhower, whoever it was you mentioned, those the shapes of those stories started to appear to you.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like you forced those stories to fit this shape. The shapes, this is what happens with mastery. And this is why it's a touch with the sublime. They spoke, the situation, the book itself spoke to you and you obeyed its command. Like, what is that process that gets you there? Like, why do you think, for instance, Lou Gehrig rose up out of all the stories you must have researched for this?
It's weird. Yeah, there's kind of a magic to it. I think you've had Elizabeth Gilbert on. You know, she calls it like the big magic. But there is a magic to it. And then it's also this weird process. Like, you tend to have a hunch, and then you follow that hunch, and then it reveals something that you didn't even know. So, like, obviously, I'm writing a book about self-discipline, and I wanted to talk like endurance or perseverance or commitment. That's a facet or a function of discipline. So I was just sort of sitting as I was loosely kind of thinking about what the book would be. I was like, oh, maybe Lou Gehrig would be a character. And so I went and I was like, I'll get a book about Lou Gehrig. And I skipped over all like the recently published books, and I found like the oldest one that I could find. And it was fascinating. It was written by this guy who had like gone to school with him or the same school as him. It wasn't probably scholarly accurate, but it was just like really, really inspiring. But it wasn't nearly enough. I mean, I probably write 5,000, 6,000 words about Lou Gehrig in the book. And that book probably gave me 200 words or something, you know? So then I read another book and another book. I think it's just out of frame. I don't want to mess up it, but I read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think I read 6 or 7 books about Lou Gehrig, plus watched a bunch of videos, plus read newspaper articles from that time, you know, plus watched a movie. You know, I just consumed everything I could about this period. Another example, Queen Elizabeth is one of the characters in the book. I mean, this is a 300-page book about Queen Elizabeth, 600-page, 600-page, 200-page, 300-page. You know, I think I read 4,000 pages of books about Queen Elizabeth. Like, I had a vague sense that they would be what I wanted to talk about, but then I also had to really go find it, and then also I had to fall in love with them as an exemplar of what I was talking about. And that's what gets me excited. You can see right here, this is, let's say, 200, 800, 400, 400. You know, I probably read 3 or 4 other books, but I've read, you know, several thousand pages about Harry Truman, who's a character in the book that I'm writing now. You know, you have to have that level of commitment / fascination to get what you end up writing about someone.
And also, I'm wondering, to what extent are these stories about other people also stories about you? So for instance, Lou Gehrig, in some ways, you portray him as the direct opposite of his father. And you and I have spoken on the podcast before about some of the disagreements you've had with your father,
sure,
particularly on the political side. And I wonder if that drew you in as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, just for people who didn't know, Lou Gehrig, like, it's ironic. Lou Gehrig has the longest streak in baseball for, you know, decades and decades, never misses a day of work, is deeply committed, respects the gift. His father was notorious for faking being sick to not have to go to work. His father was basically a bum, is what you would say. He wasn't like homeless. His father was like a bum. He was a lazy guy. And so clearly a bunch of Lou Gehrig's commitment is a reaction against his father. My relationship with my dad is complicated, and I'd say we're very similar in a lot of ways. My dad, super hardworking, always had a million irons in the fire, you know, fascinated with history, all this stuff. So I don't know how much the stuff I'm writing about is a reaction against that. But I would say like 100% of the stories that I tell in the book, they're not about me, but they are me seeking to understand myself and the world through the characters. Like, I think you're not being honest if you're just writing reverently about these other people. I'm trying to use them as a way to understand things and to communicate things. And I'm learning as I'm writing. I definitely don't want it to come off as like, I am a master of discipline and this is right. Like Jocko Willink can write his books from the position of being Jocko Willink. And, you know, he is giving his worldview and strategies from discipline as, you know, not just a Navy SEAL, but as a instructor and trainer of Navy SEALs and leader of Navy SEALs. That's not only not who I am, that's not what writing is for me. For me, writing is the exploration, the study of these ideas, not the preaching of the ideas.
Yeah, and I think that's what gives it the filter of being able to say something unique, because like Queen Elizabeth is a great story. Everyone watched The Crown or knows about Queen Elizabeth and knows a lot of the things she did. But you have a very specific focus. You talk about how many people she's shaken hands with, something like 4 million people. She's had tea with 2 million people.
Yeah.
She's traveled millions of miles by boat just to see everyone. And I remember, I don't know if I was at your very first talk, the talk we did at Mastermind Talks in, I think it was 2013.
Yeah.
And you clearly were like, I think like you almost like your back was to the audience. Like you clearly had this distaste that you've since gotten over for kind of interacting with people who wanted to interact with you. And it seemed like that your story of Queen Elizabeth was a story of someone who by birth was forced to interact with 4 million people. And it wasn't like her thing, but it became her thing in a way. And through that, she achieved a higher North Star, which is serving the interests of, you know, an empire.
You know, it's fascinating. I actually, that subtext is actually a very good read. And it wasn't one that I thought of one time, because she was kind of an introverted person forced into a fundamentally extroverted but constrained role. I was just fascinated. Like I found her so interesting because like power usually comes with so many freedoms. And what to me is so interesting about the power and influence she has is that it's primarily rooted in what she is not able to do. And her greatness was in the fact that she never did it, right? Like she never got involved in politics and like she never, she never micromanaged. She never intervened. She followed her sort of ceremonial role and turned it into this kind of transcendent great thing. And I think I was also interested in the challenge of writing about her and not just repeating the greatest hits from the TV show. Like I tried to find stuff that maybe people didn't know. And that's why I had to read so many books about her. But I feel like I'm, Robert Greene does this, I think, better than anyone, but like, you know, if I'm telling a story about how once I had an opinion that I didn't express, and that's what, you know, self-discipline is really about, I just don't think that's very interesting, right? Like, I want to tell the story of the Queen of England, you know, going 70 years without ever giving an on-the-record statement to the media and how incredibly difficult that would be. In anyone who's ever been misquoted or attacked or criticized, like all you want to do is be like, whoa, 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 let me correct the record, you know, let me explain. And she would never did that. And so I just found her to be endlessly fascinating in that regard. And you know, like Lou Gehrig is sort of famous for one thing, but because that thing is so interesting, we almost gloss over how impressive what they did actually was.
Yeah, and look, every story in this book was equally incredible and fascinating, and I got many levels of lessons to be found. And so, look, this book, the Discipline is Destiny, is the second of four about the four stoic virtues. Courage is Calling was the first. Discipline is Destiny is the second, and the subtitle here is The Power of Self-Control. It's funny because Discipline is Destiny. I sort of feel like almost Destiny is the subtitle, but then there's The Power of Self-Control is also a subtitle.
Yeah.
But what's the third and the fourth?
So the cardinal virtues are courage, self-discipline, justice, and wisdom. So I think I could say I'm halfway. I think that's not exaggerating where I am, but I'm about halfway through the Justice book. And I'm trying, again, the challenge on every book is like, how do you write about the thing, but not in the way that people think that you want to write about it? So when people hear justice, I think they think like the legal system, or they think politics, or they think social justice. And obviously that's all a component of justice. But to me, like, or to the Stoics, at least, justice was like doing the right thing and how to do the right thing and when to do the right thing and how to bring, you know, the right thing into the world. So that's the book that I'm writing now. And then when I finish that, I have to write one about the pursuit of, rather than the, you know, attainment of wisdom.
Well, that's interesting that you refer to it that way, because young people, let's say there are young people and old people. Let's say there are two categories of people. Are young people ever wise? Because they don't have enough experience to kind of have the pattern recognition to convert that to wisdom. So it's good that you refer to it as the pursuit of, because when you're younger, you can pursue without and get pleasure from that before you attain.
Well, it's funny. I literally, that was the first time those words had ever come out of my mouth, because I haven't really started that book, but I wrote it down on a note card, and I will revisit it in about a year. Because I haven't quite, one of the reasons I saved that book for last is it feels like it's the hardest one in the whole series. And it feels like, I don't want to say it's the one I'm least qualified to write, but it's the one that is most presumptuous to write. And so I've kind of been intimidated by the whole process. But I think if I, you know, from what I just said, if I write it more from the perspective of the pursuit of wisdom, which is something you never get to, but you are always getting closer to, that is a more appropriate / possible perspective on wisdom, as opposed to, you know, let me tell you how I am wise.
Right. I think that's right. Because, and also there's something superhero origin quality to the pursuit of, like,
yes,
like we know Martin Luther King, for instance, was a great man. I Have a Dream was the greatest speech ever. But what did he do 20 years earlier that planted the seeds so he knew how to make a speech like that?
Yes.
You know, not only from the perspective of racism, but how to actually construct a speech that moves an entire generation of people.
You know, and if I have behind me, this is the Taylor Branch series on Martin Luther King. It's incredible. There's a moment in the book, this is right around the time of the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, sort of Rosa Parks forces the hand of all these civil rights leaders. They were sort of talking about these things, and then all of a sudden she does it, and then she's thrown in jail. And there's this moment, I'm forgetting the names of all the characters involved, and I may write about it at some point, but basically, one of the pastors is like, you know, this lady did this thing. Are we going to back her up, or are we going to be cowards? And Martin Luther King raises his hand and he says, like, I'm not a coward. I'll lead the organizing effort. And to me, that's, you know, you talk about the hero's journey. That's the call to adventure, right? He's asked in that moment, are you going to do something about this, right? And he steps forward instead of stepping back. And, you know, history is forever changed as a result of that singular moment. And, you know, the I Have a Dream speech all these years later would not have been possible without that happening.
Yeah, it's really interesting things that you're focusing on. And that's why I love all your books so much and love talking about this stuff every time you have a new book come out. So I can't wait for these next two as well.
I know, I appreciate it. And you actually read the books before you interview people, which is very nice and not at all the norm.
And I know, and I tell Jay, it's hard for him sometimes because I want to interview a lot of people whose books I admire and enjoy. And I don't know if you've read Slouching Towards Utopia by Brad DeLong. It's an economic history of America. It's a very good book, and I think you would enjoy it. But it was, you know, like an 800-page book, and then your book, and he schedules these podcasts back to back. So it's like, all I do is read. Like, I try to explain, you know, my wife will say to me, oh, you're just doing like an hour's worth of podcast today. No, I've got 6 hours of reading for that podcast.
Well, I try to keep them short for you.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Because I even said to her, oh, I'm reading this book. And she said, it looks like a short book. And I'm like, no, it's 300 pages. It's still a book. But your books always have so many fascinating stories. It's a pure pleasure. So once again, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and good luck on this, on the next book.
Thanks for having me.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.